My name is Phil Angstrom, and I'm here doing a few things on astronomy or astronomy-related topics. And today I thought we'd look a little bit at the figure of Galileo and review something of what he did or tried to do and what his status today is with respect to the Roman Catholic Church. I don't know if you've heard about the things the Roman Catholic Church has been mulling over with respect to Galileo.
Oh, yeah.
They've been changing their attitude toward him. And that's a rather interesting story, I think. There was the, I think in 19, when was it? Several years ago, there was an anniversary in which the death of Galileo was celebrated or remembered. And there was quite a bit of material coming out then about Galileo. And there's continuing interest, I think, in his life and his work, because he was such a powerful shaping influence in the way in which we think about science and also about matters of religion and science. Are you somewhat familiar with the background of the Copernican Revolution and what led to it and so on, and the figures that were involved there? What do the names of Copernicus and Ptolemy and Kepler mean to you?
Are you
familiar?
Yeah, a couple of them.
Ptolemy, of course, was representative of the old system, and lived in Alexandria, which is in northern Africa. At the time he lived and worked there, Alexandria was the intellectual center of the world, really. A very marvelous library there, and many excellent scholars. And Ptolemy himself lived around 150 AD is when he did most of his work. And what was characteristic of his work was that it was geocentric. That is, his notion of the world was geocentric, which means that everything moves around the earth. And also Aristotelian, that is, he was much influenced by the philosopher Aristotle. And Aristotle had the belief that because God was perfect, all things in nature, or all the motions of the planets, for example, had to be perfect circles. So that everything moved around the earth in perfect circles, and any planet in the sky had to follow perfect circular paths, and so on. But to make that work out, he had to develop what he called epicycles. So not only did the planets move around the earth, but as they did so, they formed other circles. And by this means, he was able to describe all the motions of the planets reasonably well for that time. But I think the amazing thing about Ptolemy's work is that it was the dominant view for 13 centuries. 13 centuries. It was not until the time of Copernicus, in fact, that Ptolemy's view began to slip. The way in which he calculated things, the way in which he viewed things, his tables, his observations, they were all in full use for 13 centuries. Now that's a long time for any one view of the world to persist. Then along came Nicholas Copernicus. We don't know much about his childhood, but you know what nationality he was? Nicholas Copernicus was a Pole. He was born in Poland, and he was born in an age which was, of course, part of the Renaissance, and there was a great deal of exploration and much curiosity on the part of people in those times. So young Nicholas became interested in many, many things. From his childhood, he had been related to the church. His uncle was a bishop in the church, and the uncle took some considerable interest in young Nicholas and saw that he got a good education at the University of Krakow. And then after Nicholas showed much promise as far as a student of astronomy, so he was encouraged to study astronomy as much as he was able. And but that was not quite sufficient for Copernicus. He wanted to nonetheless go to Italy, and study church law, that is canon law, which he did. He went to Rome and got his doctor's degree in canon law. Then he came back to his hometown again, and eventually himself became very important in the church in Poland, and finished out his life as a high official in the Roman Catholic Church, as canon of the cathedral there. But he continued to maintain his interest in astronomy, and during his lifetime did his writing of his major work, which was called De Revolutionibus, written in Latin, of course. And this he had thought of publishing, but it was so controversial that he delayed publishing, and not until he was on his deathbed was this published. And that was in 1543 that this was finally published. The reason that what Copernicus did was reduce the number of epicycles that Ptolemy had included in his plan, and he did this by making the planets move about the sun instead of about the earth. That was a great simplifying step for him, and resulted in a much more appealing and simple system than Ptolemy had used. So there developed a kind of interest in what Copernicus had done, but there wasn't an overwhelming change in people's minds because of Copernicus' own work. But he was the one who wrote the initial major work that proposed that the sun was at the center. There was an earlier Greek astronomer who lived 200 or 300 years BC, and that was Hipparchus. He's sometimes called the father of astronomy. He had proposed that the planets moved about the sun, but had never, the idea had not caught on in his time. Now the next figure is that of Johannes Kepler, who was born in 1571 in Germany, and as a child was very weak and sickly, but described as being unusually bright and a very clever student. Kepler got a scholarship to the University of Tübingen in southern Germany and went there to study mathematics and astronomy. And then in his third year, he was, as one book says, summoned, I'm not sure what that means, but summoned nonetheless to go to Graz, Austria. And there he taught astronomy and became the provincial astronomer. And somewhere along the line there, he became a Copernican. He decided he wanted to devote the rest of his life to the study of astronomy, and he was committed to the notions that Copernicus had expressed in Copernicus' work. He wrote later to one of the teachers he had in his boyhood. He said, "For a long time I wanted to become a theologian. For a long time I was restless. Now, however, behold how through my efforts God is being celebrated in astronomy." So, I think... Hi.
Hi. Did I just make it?
Yeah. So we're talking about the early people in the Copernican story. Mm-hmm. I mentioned a little bit about Ptolemy and his idea of the planetary system, and then Copernicus, and now a little bit about Kepler. Mm-hmm. You're familiar with the names, I imagine. Mm-hmm. Johannes Kepler, who was went to the university because he wanted to become a Lutheran clergyman. He wanted to become a pastor. But then, as I mentioned in this quote here, he became enamored with astronomy and saw that as a way in which God would use his life to give glory to God. So he was, throughout his life, a deeply religious person. Eventually, Kepler found his way to Poland too, and was put in charge of the astronomical work in one area in Poland. And he became the successor of a very well-known observer named Tycho Brahe. Tycho was Danish, but had lived and worked in Poland for most of his life, had an observatory there. And Tycho had made extensive, very accurate observations of the sky, but did not develop much philosophy or theory from it. Well, Kepler took over these observations and proceeded to try to substantiate the Copernican theory and understand the motions of the planets better. And eventually, Kepler came out with his three laws of planetary motion. And you've probably heard of these. I don't know if they're familiar to you, and we won't go through them, but one of them said that the planets move not in circles, but rather move in elliptical patterns. An ellipse is an elongated or stretched out kind of circle. And another one spoke about the way in which the planets, or the rate at which the planets move around the sun. It said that in equal times, the so-called radius vector, the line between the sun and the planet, sweep out equal areas. So if the planet is near the sun, then it has to move over a larger arc in order to sweep out an equivalent area. Whereas if it's farther away, it only moves through a smaller distance along its orbit to sweep out the same distance, same area. And then the third one had to do with the matter of periods of the planets. I recall when I was in college, I was and just developing an interest in astronomy. I happened to ask my physics teacher how the planets move, and he told me about the three laws of Kepler, and had written them down on the back of an envelope, and I still have that envelope because I thought those laws were so interesting and so impressive. Well, anyway, Kepler's work became another step in convincing the people about the rightness of the Copernican point of view. The reaction of the public was not altogether positive, and you may have heard some of the arguments. People said, well, this is impossible. If the Earth is moving about the sun, it's going to go so fast that if you stand outside, you're going to be blown off the Earth. Others said, if the Earth is indeed moving and you toss a stone in the air, it's going to come down over there someplace instead of beneath the spot where you threw it up. Other arguments like this that they can show, you know, the strangeness of the idea to the people. It was a preposterous notion to most people. And of course, the Old Testament references to the motion of the earth were brought in as arguments against it, mainly the story of Joshua and marching around the city. And in that story it says that the sun stood still. And that didn't quite square with their beliefs. The earth was, after all, in their minds, the center of everything, and that the sun could come to a stop out there. If you said that the sun was the center and we were on the earth, it didn't quite fit with them. They used that verse anyway as a reference. Now, Galileo himself was born in 1564. Yeah, that's 99 years before 1564. Copernicus was born in 1473. So you see, Galileo was born not quite 100 years later. So all of these things, of course, take time. He was a professor of mathematics at Padua in Italy, which was one of the main learning centers in Italy at that time. and gave early support to Copernicus's ideas, but didn't do much with them initially. But he was nonetheless convinced that Copernicus's view was right. And then about that time, the Dutch began to grind lenses. And Galileo heard of this and thought that the use of lenses would be very interesting. So he got a hold of some, learned the technique, and made his own telescope and began to look at the planets through that. And you may recall some of the things he saw that convinced him that Copernicus was right. So, for example, he saw
the moons of Jupiter.
Okay, saw the moons of Jupiter. What did that say to him?
That the satellites, that Jupiter's satellites went around Jupiter, and it's sort of like, I'm not exactly sure, but it's sort of like how the planets went around.
Okay, so perhaps the Earth was not true that only around the Earth did satellites move, as people had believed. It was not only around the Earth that things took their courses, but there were other planets out there, other objects in space about which things moved too, and perhaps the Sun was one of those. Perhaps things moved around the Sun rather than only around the Earth. What else did he see that struck him as convincing? Recall how he looked at the Moon? If you look at the Moon, let's say a quarter moon, when you can see the twilight line on the face of the Moon, you can see the shadows of the mountains that are on the Moon. And so the Moon, he knew then, was not a nice, smooth, perfect sphere that Ptolemy had said it must be. All the planets had to be nice, smooth, perfect spheres out there. And now the Moon was not a nice, smooth, perfect object out there. Then he turned his telescope on the Milky Way. And the Milky Way, to the people of that time, had looked simply like a bright stripe across the sky. They did not imagine there were any stars that caused that brightness. But Galileo turned his telescope toward that and saw that the brightness was not simply a kind of milkiness there, but instead was caused by infinitely many, 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 many other stars that were simply invisible to them before, to the naked eye. And when you realized that, you saw that why, there must have been millions of things in space out there, and that the universe was far, far more complex than Ptolemy had ever perceived it to be, and that I don't know that Galileo ever suggested that there might be life on other planets, but one of his predecessors had, a man named Giordano Bruno. He had suggested that perhaps the universe was infinite, and that because of that he was burned at the stake. So this was a very repulsive idea to people of Galileo's time. Okay, so then also he looked at Venus, and as you know, Venus is one of the so-called inferior planets. If you move from the Sun outward, you first of all have Mercury, then Venus, then Earth, then Mars, and so on. And the planets that move inside the Earth's orbit are called inferior planets. And these have the characteristic that they go through phases like our Moon does. There's a quarter moon and a full moon and a new moon and so on. And the same way with Venus. There's a time when Venus is fully illuminated and very bright. And as it moves around and gets between you and the Sun, you see a quarter Venus and a sliver of Venus, that sort of thing. So this convinced Galileo likewise that there was at least one planet that moved around the Sun, and along with the others. Okay, so Now, Galileo introduced a new way of to discover the truth, particularly truth about nature. And Galileo said over and over that nature is a book to be read. You find that reference quite often in his writings. Nature is a book to be read. Galileo claimed for the truth which he discovered a certainty which, in the eyes of many, belonged to God alone. In the theology of the church at that time, it was believed that only God could know things perfectly, and that any knowledge that humankind had was infected, always inaccurate, always not fully right, especially about nature. You could not know things, certainly about nature. Only God had perfect knowledge. And Galileo responded with this statement. He said, certainly the godly intellect knows infinitely more truths, for it knows them all. The perception of these few truths, however, which are known to the human intellect, has, in my opinion, the same objective certainty as godly perception, for it sees the necessity of its conclusions, and there is no higher level of certainty. Galileo was sure that that by means of geometry and mathematics, we could arrive at conclusions that were fully as accurate and complete and correct as God himself might know them, which was, in the eyes of the church fathers, just not really a good idea. And Galileo also affirmed that when we looked at nature, God did not try to lie to us in nature. If we can read something in nature, that in a sense is another way in which God is speaking to us. He spoke often of the book of books and the book of nature. You find this also in his writings quite often. The book of books being the Bible, and the book of nature being, of course, nature itself. And we read both of them. You read one of them as you read the Bible, though with you have statements in prose, you try to understand them and see what's being said. And the book of nature you read with a language that's appropriate to nature. And that, to Galileo, was a language of geometry and mathematics. You try to discern the laws of nature. He said, both are proclamations of God. The Bible in his words and nature in his works. Both scripture and nature proceed from the divine word. And perhaps one of the most famous quotations from Galileo is following. He said, the Bible shows us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. The Bible shows us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. Well, the church declared Copernican teaching, or Copernicanism, false and erroneous in 1616, and commanded Galileo never to defend or hold the doctrine again. And so Galileo stopped speaking and remained quiet, did not publish what he wanted to say. And he remained quiet until 1623. Let's see, that'd be 7 years. And then, interestingly, a churchman who was a friend of Galileo became the Pope. And so now Galileo had a friend who was in the papacy. And Galileo went back to him and thought he might at last be able to publish his works. And the Pope now said to him, yes, you may publish your works. You may discuss the theories of Aristotle and of Copernicus. And then he awaited the book to come out. Well, when it finally came out, it wasn't the kind of book the Pope was expecting, because Galileo had written a book in which he included, used a dialogical approach. he had three people speaking. And these three people, of course, discussed the Copernican theory. And one of them, who seemed to be representing the Pope, was not a very attractive person. And the Pope was offended by this. And the result was that Galileo was again called forth and taken to trial, and the verdict was imposed was that he be put under house arrest, and there he remained for the rest of his life. A very, very sad experience for Galileo, because he had always been a very devout person, and regarded this as a very, very serious and difficult punishment for him. Well, now maybe you've got some observations or questions here that thus far you've seen stories of dramatizations of Galileo's life on television, I suppose, or the accounts leading up to his house arrest are shown. When Galileo finally died, Pope Urban VIII said Galileo was a great nuisance to Christianity. So, not a very kind judgment. And the consequences for the church, what, maybe you have some observations there, what was the consequence of for the church for of, as far as Galileo's work was concerned? What happened after the trial? Well, were science and religion good friends after that? No. What were science and religion like prior to Galileo's time? How did they function? Or just
very
like
together.
Very much together, that's right. If you studied religion, you would very likely study science and vice versa. Anyone trained in university was trained in both areas, and there was no conflict whatsoever felt. Very, very much together. And after Galileo, there was a rather strict separation there. And even Galileo seems to have separated the two in his mind. Galileo wrote things later, but whereas in his early writings, he had always linked religion to his science, in his later writings, he speaks of science but does not draw upon theological ideas whatsoever. So in effect, Galileo had separated the two completely. He remained a churchman. He retained his faith. When he did his work in science, it was divorced from his religious thinking. No particular connection. You may know the name of Hans Kuhn, the Roman Catholic theologian. Heard the name of Hans Kuhn? He was for many years a professor of theology in Tübingen, where Kepler himself has studied. And Hans Kuhn himself got in trouble during the 70s, I believe, because he questioned the authority of the papacy. And now he is allowed to teach theology, but not, or teach religion, but not in an official Roman Catholic capacity. He is not allowed to teach divinity students, for example. But a remarkably able and profound thinker. I heard him speak in Spokane once in the 60s. He spoke at Gonzaga, and he sounded very much like a Lutheran, I thought. Interesting person. I heard him speak again in, I guess, in the late 70s or early 80s when he traveled to North America. But Hans Kuhn said that the Copernican Revolution and Galileo's being thrown out of the, well, being brought to trial was one of the three great tragedies in the Christian Church in the West. One was the separation, and which took place many years before, and the other was the Reformation. He saw that as being very divisive in the church, and then the trial of Galileo. Those three things, he said, were the three greatest tragedies in the Western Church. And he felt that ever since that time, the Church has not had the kind of rapport with science that it should have had. And the Church really lost out greatly, because it no longer had the good conversation it had previously with the scientific community.
It would have eventually happened, though. The separation.
Absolutely, I think so. Yes, that's right. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
If not, then with the coming of evolution. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, the scientific community, after about another 100 years, adopted the Copernican view wholeheartedly. What surprises me is the time it takes for these things to really get fully in place. So from the time of Copernicus to the time when Newton came along, which was about, Galileo died in 1642, and that was the year Newton was born. And then Newton did his big work on gravitation within his first, by the time he was about 26 years old. That's the amazing thing about Newton. Newton went to Cambridge and got his master's degree in mathematics and in physics. And then the plague came along, and all the students were sent home for 2 years. So he went back to his farm, to the farm where he had grown up. And in those 2 years, he developed the calculus, he developed the theory of gravitation, he did his initial work on the theory of light, all of that, when he was just a young fellow, 24, 25, 26. So, and everything he did later than that was essentially just an elaboration upon what he did during those 2 years. It's a remarkable life, remarkable. So you young people, shouldn't minimize your potential by any means, because what he did was just astonishing. Anyway, by the time Newton came around, then these ideas were fully in place. But the one who contributed in the major sense was Galileo. He was the one who provided the big arguments for the Copernican view. And then Newton came along with the final statement. But it took 200 years or so for this revolution to take place.
Did the Church hold all the information from everybody else? I mean, who had, like, his books, Galileo's books?
After the trial, this information was not available to the public. That's right.
So the Church had kept it?
Yes.
And when did they finally release it?
Well, it was only recently, I think in the 70s, that they finally let the papers pertaining to the trial become public information.
1970?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
It was all kept secret. So that's why there was a bit of a flourish at that time of renewal of interest in Galileo. In 1979, the 10th of November, I think it was 100 days after a ceremony honoring Einstein, they had a little ceremony in the Vatican. And at that time, Pope John Paul II agreed that Galileo had suffered far too much. And then he said, Galileo's judges were incapable of dissociating faith from an age-old cosmology. And another quote from Pope John Paul, Galileo, a sincere believer, showed himself to be more perceptive in the interpretation of Scripture than the theologians who opposed him. Interesting. The error of the theologians of the time when they maintained the centrality of the earth was to think that our understanding of the physical world structure was in some way imposed by the literal sense of sacred scripture. And that's quite a concession, I think, on the Pope to say that Galileo had a better interpretation of these scriptures than the theologians of the time did. Now, I'm not sure what will be the eventual outcome of this. It still isn't settled. But only a month ago, I read an article in which there was a kind of an update of this, and it didn't say much more than what I mentioned, except that possibly the Roman Catholic Church will eventually come forth with a final statement saying that I don't know what to say about Galileo, but they can't say, "We forgive you, Galileo," because Galileo didn't really commit any heresy. What he did was irritate the Pope. what he had said was not officially declared heresy, so they can't accuse him of that. So that's often been the story that's been repeated, that Galileo was guilty of heresy, but that was not actually the case. There was a movement a few years ago to have Galileo raised to sainthood, but it didn't get very far. I think some lawyer in Rome was eager to have that accomplished, but didn't float. Okay, any comments or observations? There are some Lutheran footnotes to this. The Lutheran Church had a number of schools in existence at that time, and Copernicus's writings were being taught in all of them. And there were two figures, one fellow named Rheticus, R-H-E-T-I-C-U-S, who was a teacher in a Lutheran school who did a great deal, and was very encouraging of Copernicus's writings. And then Osiander, another Lutheran, who wrote the preface to Copernicus's work. And in it, he said something to the effect that this work need not be true nor even probable. Its essential purpose is to furnish a model whereby further calculations could be made. And that was to avoid arousal of the Roman Catholic authorities. If Copernicus's work had been put forth as being the truth, then there would have been much more reaction against it. But this preface said, no, it doesn't need to be seen as the truth. Just think of it as a kind of tool to help us calculate things more easily. It's not to be seen as a correct portrayal of how things are, but instead just as a device whereby we can better understand what's going on. So that was a way around, or a way of kind of a slippery way of avoiding further criticism from the church authorities. Then also, Kepler was as we said, a very staunch Lutheran, and learned of Copernicus's writings from his Lutheran teacher in Tübingen. Wrote a book, and he sent it off to Rome because he wanted the Pope to see it. Well, the messenger with whom he sent the book forgot about delivering it in Rome, and it seems on his way back he stopped in Padua, dropped the book off with Galileo, and some think that was the first time that Galileo had a good copy of, well, had another person's strong opinion on Copernicus. So in that way, Kepler's book may have had some influence upon Galileo's own thinking. And there's a good chance, or a fair chance, that Galileo first heard of Copernicus through a student who came to study at Padua, a student who had himself studied in a Lutheran school in Rostock. So there are some interesting connections here between the Lutheran Church at that time and Galileo and the Copernican movement. Any connections you see between what happened then and what kinds of things go on today? Relationships between the scientific community and the church today? How do you see them? What influence do you think the church has on science? Or what kinds of ramifications do new scientific discoveries have upon the thinking of the church? Any issues that are contemporary that involve both very dramatically or in a significant way? Things that scientists conclude nowadays in any way affect the teachings of the church anymore? Or is this the only instance?
I this think was in a very evolution, when they teach evolution, I think there's been conflicts of teaching evolution in schools, like in high schools, junior highs. Because, I mean, I know there are a lot of parents that are opposed, very religious parents that are opposed to the teaching of evolution.
Yeah, certainly when evolution first came on the scene, it had a very strong impact, didn't it, on the church, and a very strong reaction from the church.
My parents were very much against it. My father's a minister, when I was learning evolution in school, he was very much opposed to it.
It's still a bone of contention in many places. There was a movement in California a while back, I think, I heard recently that one of the school boards was taken over almost completely by creationists, for example.
Oh.
And they have a fairly, they were requiring that all the school book, that in all the courses, in the science courses, the creationist view be presented.
Also, along with evolution. But so wouldn't that be somewhat of a contradiction then? So you're teaching students one thing, and then teaching a student another thing. But to me, I believe in like evolution, also creationism at the same time. But other people don't believe that. I mean, like they're contradictions. Just like science and religion, it's contradictory, you know. To me, it'd be very confusing to a student to teach both of them. And I was more for the evolution than for, evolution seems to make more sense. And I guess that we tend to believe things what we see or that's in front of us instead of having faith with, you know, reading the Bible and, you know, believing what the Bible says. And I don't know, it just seems like the more I get to know more people that are in the scientific field. I see that they're not as religious as those. They're not in the scientific field. Do you understand? My major is zoology. Half of the people it's just coincidence, but like a lot of people that I work with, either they're not very active in church, or one person's even atheist, and maybe it's just because I'm just in the wrong crowd right there. It's just, I don't know, but some more. I even asked them, like my astronomer professor, how he felt about religion. And he says that he believes that there is a deity, but he's not like, he's more into the science. And then there is a big difference between the two. There's no gap in between. I mean, there's no bridge in between science and religion. They're just totally different.
Okay, so some people get around that by saying that there are two approaches to two paths to truth or something like that. I think this is a common
reaction.
How
do you feel about it? How do you feel about it?
Yeah, well, I think that there are some very strong irreconcilable differences between science and religion. I really do. Yeah, and I've been a I was raised in the church and been trained in the church, and I've also studied the sciences quite a bit. And I see some connections between the two. I think that a scientist certainly has to operate with a high sense of ethics, for example. Mm-hmm. And I think that every scientist has within him a certain kind of faith, but it's not the same kind of faith you speak of in the church. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of trustfulness going ahead and without foregone conclusions about things. And many people, you can find very serious studies that suggest that that modern science would not have come into being if it had not been for the background of the Christian Church. Mm-hmm. The Christian Church believes that the universe was created with a certain sense of order, that this order determines how things move and how things relate. And of course, that's what science is all about, to, mm-hmm. to seek out the laws that lie behind this universe that's been created. I think the big conflict comes when you speak about the personal matter of salvation and science. There seems to be no connection at all to speak of. If you're talking about ideas of creation and how the world came into being, there I think you can find some bridges. But, you know, Einstein was a very religious person in many ways. But he did not believe in a personal God. He did not see how God could relate to him personally, that God could love him personally. And I think that's a hang-up for many people in science. Mm-hmm. They're willing to say, yes, there's a deity that somehow brought all of this about or lies behind it. But the story of the cross and salvation and these things are not altogether real to them. So that to me seems to be the place where the trouble lies. Werner Heisenberg, who was a very eminent German physicist, and after whom we had, or under whom he devised the Heisenberg principle, which you may know of from physics, you know, the uncertainty principle, which is a well-established idea in physics. And among other things, suggests that every time we observe something, we influence that object. But basically, it has to do with the motions inside the atom. He said the uncertainty principle says you cannot know both position and velocity of an electron at the same time. If you know the position, you haven't sufficient information to find the velocity, and vice versa. You can't know both at the same time. Hence this uncertainty. And that sort of pervades all of quantum theory. He was also a devout Christian. But in his later writings, he said much what you have said, that he saw no way in which you could bridge the gap between the two, that they were separate entities, and that they were divorced from one another. There's a tremendous amount of literature in the science and religion, a great deal of study, and it's interesting to see other parallels, I think, between science and religion. How does a theologian proceed, let's say, compared to how a scientist proceeds? There you see some ways in which they... I recall a story about Karl Barth, who was a very eminent theologian right after the Second World War. He went to a meeting once, and there was a scientist there. And the scientist approached Karl Barth and said, how can you theologians call yourself thinkers, or how can you possibly arrive at your conclusions in any sensible sort of way? And Karl Barth said, well, I do the same thing you do. I gather evidence, and that he meant the scriptures. I have my data, and I have my laws of thought. And then I try to reason from this data to arrive at some conclusion. Well, I'm not sure the scientist was satisfied, but anyhow, that was the answer Karl Barth had. I was a little bit... we lived in Pullman for a while, and I had a lot of contact with college faculty there. And my observation was that the people in the sciences were nonetheless as inclined to be in the church as were the people in the social sciences and psychology. Those were the ones that I found were the most rejecting of the church. I don't know what your reaction is to that, but it seemed to me that that was the case. I know many people in religion will take up psychology and study it very much, but you take an average university psychology department and inquire how many in that department are active in any kind of religious group, and I don't think you'll find very many.
That's what I was saying. I worked in the psychology department.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's what I said. There was hardly anybody who was religious at all.
Yeah. If you went to a chemistry department, you might find more, really. That was my experience, anyway, in Poland. Mm-hmm. There were several people in chemistry and in physics and such who were active in the congregation, but there wasn't a single psychologist. And there was not a single sociologist that I know. And you would think these people especially would be interested in the life of the church because after all, a sociologist looks at social groups,
yeah.
The church is a social community, or at least it has aspects about it that are sociological. They might study the church from a distance, I guess, but not get involved themselves.
So do you think that the church now has an influence on the science today? As in, like, with...
The problem with the church in North America, at least, is it's so fragmented, I think. We've got so many denominations and so many different sects and little branches and offshoots and so many interpretations that there is no way in which the church in North America speaks with any single voice.
Okay.
Contrary to what was true in Galileo's time. There was a single church that had a very, very strong voice. So the confrontation was more obvious, I guess. But yes, I think the church has an impact on science insofar as individual scientists, who are people who have a religious faith, express that faith work with their colleagues, especially through in some areas that are especially sensitive to ethical issues, like in medicine, for example. There, I think you'll find physicians who are active Christians who have some kind of influence on what happens, let's say, in medicine. And there are lots of ethical questions that arise in medicine, from abortion to transplants and transfusions and using body tissues for different purposes. And these call, I think, for very, very profound ethical insights. And the Christian ought to have at least a few ethical insights, something to say about what creation is about and reverence for life itself. Our time, I think, has passed.
Okay.
And very glad. I'm going to be on a dish team, so otherwise I continue with you here for a while. I,